Well, good morning. It's great to be with you all here again this weekend, and especially today, this Lord's Day. I love the Lord's Day. It's my favorite day of the week, even though it's the often the most difficult day of the week for me in terms of work. But hey, I get 6 days off, so who can complain, right? So good to see you all and to be back up here. And this morning, as we continue our series on the fruit of the Spirit, we've been talking about how Jesus is the true vine. He is the one whose life is exactly what God intended human beings to be. What he wanted from mankind when he created us is fully realized in the person and life of Jesus Christ like no one else. He's absolutely the model of humanity. And when we are rooted and connected to him by faith, when you're united with Christ, then he and his Spirit works in our lives to produce the kind of fruit that makes God happy, that pleases God. And not only is it pleasing to God, but is also beneficial to other people. We can be of benefit and use and good for the lives of the people who we rub shoulders with every day in our families, our homes, our workplaces, and in the church. And if we live according to our flesh, according to the things that just naturally rise up within us, we do things that are harmful to other people. But when we live according to the Spirit of Christ, we will produce fruit that is beneficial for other people. And I think most of us, all of you gathered here this morning, likely want to be good for people, helpful to people, and around people who are also good for you. And so the fruit of the Spirit really show us how Christ's life is manifest through us and how we can do that. So Jesus is the true vine. We want to bear the fruit of his Spirit in our lives. And this morning, we're sort of combining two that are very similar. They're not exactly the same. But the word goodness and kindness are found next here in Galatians chapter 5. But we're combining those together. And specifically, we're going to focus on the word kindness this morning. And they are very closely related. I think the place that I'd like for you to turn, though it's not the first passage we're going to look at, I'm going to put the first passage up on the screen, but if you want to be turning in your Bibles to the place that will be most helpful and where we're going to spend most of our time, you can turn to the Old Testament book of Ruth. So go ahead and flip over there if you want. And while we're doing that, I want to introduce the topic by simply pointing out that goodness and kindness are qualities that God possesses and that we can possess ourselves. And in Titus chapter 3, and up on the screen you'll see Titus 3 and verse 3, there's a description of mankind, of the human race, prior to the coming of Christ into the world. And it is a very accurate, though difficult to accept, reading an explanation of human nature separated from God. It's not the stuff of a Hallmark card, but it is reality. And here's the condition of mankind: cut off, severed from the vine, separated from God. And it says that we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures. Think about that. Doesn't that describe so many people today who are not connected to Christ? It's not that they're truly free. They're slaves. And what they're slaves of are their passions and desires that eventually prove to be destructive to them. Passing our days in malice and envy, hated by others and hating one another. I don't know. I can't hardly watch the news anymore. I can't hardly watch TV, but even the news anymore, because it's just so much about malice and opposition and hatred that one group of people have for another. And this truly, again, as I said a moment ago, isn't a romanticized view of human nature and who we are and what we do, but it is the biblical description and therefore the accurate description of mankind cut off, separated from God. But that's not the whole story. He continues in the next verse, beginning in verse 4, but with that great word, but. Here's a contrast. But the goodness and loving kindness. So those are the two words that are our focus this morning, aren't they? Goodness and kindness. But the goodness and loving kindness of God our Savior appeared. I love that word, appeared. God's goodness and kindness appeared. How did God's goodness and kindness appear? It appeared when he saved us, not because of works we had done in righteousness, but according to his own mercy by the washing of regeneration and renewal of the Holy Spirit, whom he poured out on us richly through Jesus Christ, our Savior. So here's man, severed and separated from God, hating and hating one another, controlled and enslaved by our lusts, our passions and desires. And then, but God intervened, his goodness and kindness appears, and it appears in the person of Jesus Christ, who brings about salvation. And salvation is not just some arbitrary thing that happens. It's God coming to us and reorienting us and changing us into a new kind of people, so that we're back into a redeemed relationship with God. Our relationship with him is now restored to one of tranquility and of peace. And those passions and desires that had enslaved us are replaced with passions and desires that are good for us and good for other people. And instead of there being malice and hatred and envy and people hating one another, it becomes a matter in which people are living at peace with one another in love and in joy and manifesting goodness and kindness. So the goodness and kindness of God are visible and made manifest to us in the person of Jesus Christ. And so we see the true value of his appearing. And it's also important to note that Jesus appeared at a time in history that was very bleak. It was very dark. The world was a mess when Jesus stepped onto the scene and stage of human history. But there's another time in Old Testament times in which there was another bleak period of human history. In fact, it could be argued that it's one of the darkest times recorded in all of Scripture, and that's the period of the judges. So if you have your Bible there to the book of Ruth, you'll notice in chapter 1 and in verse 1 that it says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, and his wife and two sons. So the setting of the story of Ruth is in the days of the judges, it says. And if you look over on the page just before the book of Ruth, the last verse of the book of Judges, we get a little bit of a taste for what it was like during the days of the judges. It says, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, this is not only a historical documentary of the fact that there was no monarchy in Israel at this day, that it was prior to the time of the united and then divided kingdom. But I think there's also, and scholars agree, that there is a hint in this that says that there was no king in Israel. It not only implies no earthly king, but there was no regard that the people had for their true king. That God himself was not regarded as their ruler and leader. And everybody, therefore, was simply doing what was right in his own eyes. Think about that. And again, sadly, that sort of describes our culture today, doesn't it? People are not regarding the authority of God as king and as Lord, as the creator of heaven and earth, the maker of mankind, the giver of our very lives. And so instead of trusting and looking to him for leadership and guidance, for him to tell us what's good and true and right and how to live our lives, we've rejected him as king, and everyone seems to simply be wanting to do what's right in their own eyes. What feels good to me, whatever I want to do, that's what I'm going to do. I recognize no real authority over me. I am the authority. And that results in some very disastrous consequences, which we're beginning to see manifest themselves in our day and time. They really manifest themselves plainly in the days of the judges. And if you're familiar with the book of Judges, you know that it was a time of darkness. It was a time in which there was violence on an amazing scale. Wickedness, evil men were running amok. It was a time of poverty. It was a time of tyranny. And it was a time of great and brutal violence. The people had turned away from the living God, and they were serving the god Baal and other deities that had populated the Canaanite peoples before they inhabited the land. And when you worship a degraded god, you become a degraded people. and you worship a God who is himself evil and wicked, then you become an evil and wicked people. And that describes Israel in the days of the judges, which is the context in which the book of Ruth opens. Now, I've kind of gone all over the place, but I want to try to boil all that down. Dark times, evil, brutal, wicked, men hated and hating one another. And then in the midst of all that darkness, the goodness and kindness of God appears. It happens most vividly in the life of Jesus, but we see it prefigured here in the book of Ruth, when in this dark period of the judges, we find two people appearing on the scene who are good and kind and bring a blessing to the world. Well, let's step back then and talk about this story of the book of Ruth, in which we see kindness manifest in such a wonderful way. In the book of Ruth, we find people living on three different levels. Three kinds of people are highlighted in the book of Ruth. First, there are those that we would simply describe as evil people. These are the ones that we've been talking about in the book of Judges, people who have turned their back on God and have given themselves over to evil. We might even describe them as demonic. And have you ever met somebody that was just evil? I haven't met too many people that way, but I have met a few. And they're just mean, right? You know anybody like that? And it can be a terrifying thing. And when people in that kind of character rise to positions of power and influence and authority, it really becomes a terrifying thing. And of course, we could go through human history and mark numerous individuals who were truly evil people, the Hitlers and people like that of the world, that seem to have not only just a human level of evil, but it's hard to imagine that there is not some sort of demonic influence in the lives of these people as they wage destruction and evil on humanity. And so such mean people are calculating and predatory. And when people turn and a culture turns its back on God, the number and proportion of these kinds of people seems to increase significantly. And that was going on in the days of the judges as the people grew worse and worse. God warns us about evil people. And he tells us in such passages as Proverbs chapter 4, verses 14 and 15, do not set foot on the path of the wicked or walk in the way of evil men. To all of us, and to the young people especially, there is such a thing as the path of the wicked. The way that deliberately sets out to harm others, to take advantage of the weaknesses that you find in other people. You find someone that you think in whatever ways, whether just mentally, emotionally, or even physically, that you can manipulate to your own ends, and you work those things to bring about satisfaction to you, even at their cost. And that's what the Bible describes as evil. It describes it as wicked. And we are told here in Proverbs chapter 4, do not go down that path. And there may come a time in your life and in my life where we feel a temptation, a draw toward using somebody, destroying their life, harming them in order to help ourselves. And God says, that's evil, that's wicked, do not walk down that path. And another thing to be aware of is don't go down that path with other people, or don't allow other people who are walking that path to take advantage of you. Recognize there are evil and wicked people in the world that you don't want to hang out with. They're there. They're there on the internet. They're in our schools. They're in workplaces. And you need to be aware of the fact that there are people who will ruin you, who will deliberately seek your harm. And they won't come with an advertisement. They don't wear a placard around their neck that says, evil person here to destroy your life. But if you allow them in and you give them some leverage, they will use it to destroy you. And if somebody is hurting you, especially if you are a young person and you find yourself under the influence of an evil person, you need to talk to somebody about that. And a lot of the times people don't talk to somebody about that. Young people don't talk to someone who's in a position to help them because they feel trapped, they feel embarrassed, they feel ashamed. Maybe they themselves have already allowed themselves to some degree to become manipulated by an evil person. And they're afraid that if they say something about what that person's doing, it's also going to expose me. It's much better to go ahead and run the risk and the trouble of being exposed yourself than to allow that evil person to continue to harm and manipulate you and others. We need to be aware that evil exists in the world. Some people may not want to believe that, as hard as it is, you know, how can you look at reality and not see the presence of evil and evil people in the world? They are there, they exist, and they will harm us, and we have to be careful and guard against them. But even more importantly, again, before we leave this point, all of us have the potential within us to become that evil person. And that's the worst thing that could possibly happen to us. Even worse than being the victim of an evil person is to have become the evil person. Don't walk down that path. Avoid it. Do not travel on it. Turn away from it. Then the second, and again, in the book of Ruth, that's the background. So many people are evil people, and they exist there in Israel at this time. The second group of people that exist in the book of Judges, and therefore the time in which Ruth lives, are foolish people. These are people who aren't consciously looking to hurt and exploit others. But because they're not mindful of God, they end up hurting themselves and hurting other people, even if inadvertently. They're just foolish. They're not paying attention. They're just going along through life. And as they go along through life, they're constantly bumping in, knocking over, and damaging things and other people. And the chief characteristic of these kinds of people is they do not listen. They do not listen to good advice. They will not heed helpful and godly counsel. In Proverbs 12, verse 15, it says, "The way of the fool seems right to him, but a wise man listens to advice." Did you get that? The way of the fool seems right to him. We always have a tendency to think we're right. But we need to check ourselves out. And one of the ways we check ourselves out is by listening to other people. Find some people that are wise. Find some people who have a track record of being good, godly people who have made wise choices in life, and listen to the things that they have to say, so that we won't just be blindly following our own desires and interests and end up finding ourselves enslaved by our passions and desires. Don't be a foolish person. And in the Bible, foolish doesn't just mean someone who is low IQ. It means someone who is of a low moral standard. Someone who is simply not listening to God's counsel and following after it. Don't be that kind of person. Don't be a foolish person. That's the kind of people we find here in the book of Ruth, and we're going to come to them in a moment. Maybe you have met some of these kinds of people yourself. The kind of person who won't take any advice or won't take any counsel. You know, they're always having trouble, and so you try to help them out, right? Maybe you should stay in school, you know, get a degree. You have to stay in school to graduate, and I disagree. I disagree with that. Okay. Well, maybe you should read a book. I don't like to read. Okay. Try maybe seeing a counselor. That's too expensive. Well, go to church. You know, you can go to church. You know, sometimes the preacher even has something good to say. You should go listen to the sermon and gather yourself around with other good people. Church starts too early in the morning. I can't get out of bed that early. So there's always a reason why the good counsel that is given, it doesn't need to be taken and is rejected. There's also the tendency among this sort of people, these foolish people, to always blame somebody else, right? It's someone else's fault. The reason that this happened to me is because, you know, the whole universe is against me, or I run with the wrong group of people, or my parents have done this, that, or the other, and so things don't work out well for me. Or sometimes people just like to play dumb. They're not dumb, but they like to play dumb because it sort of gives them an excuse and out. I did not know is their favorite expression. The world is full of mystery. You know, I did not know that if I didn't study for the test, I wouldn't get a good grade. I did not know that if I slept around, I would contract a sexually transmitted disease. It's a grand mystery. I did not know that if I slept with my boyfriend, I would perhaps find myself with an unwanted pregnancy. The world is full of strange and mysterious things. I did not know this would happen. I did not know that if I stayed up all night, you know, drinking and hanging out with my buddies, and then showed up 2 hours late for work with, you know, and forgot my pants and one of my eyes is glued shut, that the boss wouldn't look favorably upon this. Who knew? How could you know? This, everything seems to be a surprise to the foolish person. And so this is why we really need to open up and listen to God and to wise people who can help us. And this is the kind of person that we first are introduced to in the story of Ruth. At least that's my reading of it. People differ on this, and you certainly can disagree with me on the matter. But this character in Ruth chapter 1, verse 2, whose name is Elimelech, is kind of this kind of. I don't think he's an evil guy like so many of the people in the times of the judges were. But I think he's somewhat of a foolish guy. And I think that he's a foolish guy because we're told here that he gets up and he leaves Bethlehem. And he leaves Bethlehem for an interesting reason. Bethlehem is the word that means the house of bread, but there was no bread in the house of bread because the people were serving a false god and God was disciplining his people, and so there was hunger. And Elimelech decides he's going to leave Israel and go to Moab. The Moabites were a wicked people, a people that God had warned Israel not to have anything to do with because they would lead them astray. And Elimelech decides that it is a good idea to uproot his family and move from Israel, from Bethlehem, and go to Moab and live there. Not a brilliant idea. It seemed like a good idea to him. No bread here. Maybe there's bread there. We'll just go there. And so it is that he, looking for some sort of a physical advantage, a material advantage in life, is willing to sacrifice spiritually in a very significant way in order to have some kind of a physical benefit. Characteristic of a foolish person. Not looking to get into trouble, not trying to cause harm, but just blindly going about wherever his appetites lead him, and he's going to eventually lead his family into disaster. He has a couple of sons that he takes with him, along with his wife, Naomi. And when they go to Moab, things begin to go very wrong. Both of his sons die an untimely death after having married Moabite women, which again was something they weren't supposed to do. But both of the boys die, and then eventually the father dies as well. And so it's just Naomi, his wife, and her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. And so this is really bleak. I know that. And I said that goodness and kindness often appear in the bleakest of times. And so in a time in which we find evil people and foolish people, we suddenly on the scene find a couple of good people and kind and wise people. We read about these beginning in chapter 1 in verse 16 and 17. These are the kinds of people that we want to be. These are the kinds of people that please God and produce the fruit in their life that is a blessing and benefit to others. Now, this is Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi. And after her sister-in-law had left, Naomi says to Ruth, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you from me." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. What's amazing about this is she is the most unexpected and unlikely person in this whole story to turn out to be a wise and good person. She is a Moabite woman. Now, if you know your biblical history, you know the disgusting story of how the Moabite people came into being. Lot, Abraham's nephew, after he fled from the city of Sodom and Gomorrah, fled for the hills, and there, after an incestuous coupling with his daughters, one of the children that was born was named Moab, and he became the father of the Moabite tribe, the Moabite people. And they sort of went downhill from there. This was a group of people notoriously debased. And here is a woman growing up in that culture who has met a man and her family from Israel who, though foolish, are apparently still worshipers of God. And she's learned enough by observing the contrast between her culture, her way, and her God, and their culture, their way, and their God, to see that that's better than this. Even though Elimelech has made a foolish decision and some really bad things have happened, I can still see, comparing the two together, that their God is better than our God. He's holy and ours is filthy. They worship the god Chemosh, who was vile. And so she sees this and she begins to get a clue. She becomes the first step in becoming wise. And she begins to make good decisions and says, I'm going with you. I'm casting my lot with you. Your God will be my God. So she's not only devoted to and pledging her loyalty to her mother-in-law, Naomi, but more importantly and perhaps fundamentally, she is making a pledge and a confession of her faith in Jehovah God. He will be my God. And nothing, she says, is going to separate me from him and from you, but death itself. And so her mother-in-law relents and brings Ruth with her back into the land of Israel. And so in chapter 2, we continue the story and we find that when they get there and they have nothing, Ruth goes to work. So she's a widowed woman towing a now cranky mother-in-law. She's a vulnerable refugee, and she goes to work when she gets to the land to glean. Let's read verses 2 and 3 of chapter 2. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go into the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. This tells us again something important about Ruth, doesn't it? What kind of person is she? She doesn't know anybody. She's helpless. She's virtually homeless. She's a refugee in a foreign land. And yet, rather than just sitting there and complaining and waiting for something to come her way, she gets up and she goes after it. She begins to pursue what she can. What does she have? She has the strength of her hands and a determination to work. And so she goes to work. And one of the great things about God and his law in Israel, we sometimes in our moral superiority want to look back at the ancient world and specifically the laws of Israel and think of them as archaic and no good. But there was a way that God provided to care for the poor, people who were in positions like Ruth. And that was when the harvest time came, they could go into the fields, and after the landowners, harvesters, had gone through the field, gleaning the harvest, they could go after them and pick up what they had dropped. And they were also told to not glean in the corners of their field, but to leave that for the poor to be able to gather. This had a twofold benefit, or maybe more than that. It provided an opportunity for people to be generous, but it secondly provided an opportunity for the poor to receive the sustenance that they needed to survive, but did so by enabling them to have the dignity of going out and working for it, not simply receiving something for nothing. Ruth recognizes this. It may have been one of the things that she saw as a superiority of Jehovah God over Chemosh, her false deity. And so she goes to work and she begins to glean in this field. And when she gathers it, she brings it home to Naomi. It says in chapter 2 and verses 17 and 18 that she was successful in her gleaning. She gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley, a large amount. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw that what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. So she provides for herself, and she provides for her mother-in-law with her. And this reveals the kindness of Ruth, doesn't it? The most unexpected person in a time of darkness where people were evil and foolish arises a wise woman who is kind, hardworking, and thoughtful about the needs not only of herself but of her mother-in-law. And then we see that there is Ruth's counterpart, Boaz. And this is where the story gets really good. The young ladies in particular should be interested in this. You want to find you a man like Boaz. We read about him beginning in chapter 2. We'll start learning about him in chapter 2, beginning in verse 4. And I want to do a bit of a lengthy reading, but I think you'll find it worthwhile. Boaz is the man who owns the field that Ruth has gone to glean in. It says, beginning in verse 4, "Behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, 'The Lord be with you.' And they answered, 'The Lord bless you.'" So again, a time of wickedness, evil, and foolishness, Boaz is neither evil nor foolish. He's a godly man. Would you like to work for somebody that shows up when you see the boss coming into the office? He's not angry. He's not cussing at you. He's not, you know, throwing a fit. And instead, he's walking in and he's pronouncing the blessing of God on you. That's the kind of man that Boaz was. So that's how he's introduced to you. "The Lord bless you." And verse 5, Boaz says to his young man who is in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" So he sees her, notices her. He's paying attention to people. People matter to Boaz. Though he's a rich, powerful, important landowner, he sees some woman out there gleaning and he takes an interest in her. "And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, 'She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers." So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, so now he sees her, he finds out about her, and then he goes. Now again, guys, this is how you do it, okay? I know we're living in a time that everything is kind of weird and turned upside down, but you see her, you ask a little bit about her, you find out something about her character, and when you find out it's good, then you go and you talk to her. You don't send a note to your junior high buddy and say, "Hey, go ask her if she likes me." You go and you take the initiative. So he goes in verse 8. Boaz says to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women." What's he doing here? Well, I'm pretty sure what he's doing here is he is already being protective of Ruth. He knows she's very vulnerable. She's a foreign woman, unmarried, unprotected, in a ruthless time. And he says to her, "You stay here in my field. I hope there's nobody here this morning named Jeb. I'll just pick Jeb. Don't go over to Jeb's place, okay?" Single women who go over and glean in Jeb's field, it usually doesn't end up working out too well for them. You stay out of Jeb's field. You stay here in Boaz's field. I'm going to look out for you. And he says, "Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping," verse 9, "and go after them," that is, follow after his reapers. "Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told me. How you left your father and your mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done. A full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel. under whose wings you have come to take refuge. That is just so beautiful. You see what he's doing? He's praying for her. He just met her. And guys, this is another good idea. He's pronouncing God's blessing on her. The Lord bless you for what you have done. And may he give you the protection that you were seeking when you left the evil land of the Moabites to come here. And may he reward you for your faithfulness. Then she said, verse 13, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken what? Kindly. There's our word. Kindness in the midst of evil and darkness and foolishness. You have spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. But it just keeps on getting better. Verse 14, at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. So she sat beside the reapers and he passed to her the roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied. And she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her. Boaz is a kind man, just as Ruth is a kind woman. And under God's providence, these two people find each other, and their kindness for each other is just so dramatic in view of the great unkindness and evil and wickedness that was prevalent in the time in which they lived. Isn't that what God's calling us to try to be? Salt and light in a dark world? We should pop. We should stand out in the world around us in which there is so much hating and being hated, so much evil and darkness, so much people trying to use and exploit one another to their own advantage, when we can be the kind of people that say, no, I'm not going to be a worker of the flesh. I'm going to be used by the vine to produce the fruit that is pleasing to God and brings a blessing into the life of other people. It's exactly what we see in Ruth and Boaz. And by the power and strength of God, under whose protection we have sought refuge, we too can find the nourishment and the strength that we need to be that blessing, to be that blessing for other people that God puts in our life. And so Ruth and Boaz are tremendous examples of what we can be and how we can bear this fruit of the spirit of kindness toward others. There's a couple of other verses here. I'll just make mention of them. In verse 20, Naomi makes mention of Boaz's kindness. And in chapter 3 and verse 10, Ruth, when Boaz decides to marry Ruth, yeah, young ladies, you want to read this story. When he decides to marry Ruth, he makes reference there to her kindness toward him. So Ruth and Boaz are both wonderful illustrations of kindness, but in particular, I'd like to close this morning by saying they are especially good examples for husbands and wives to think about the importance of kindness and goodness in our marriages. There are a lot of ingredients that go into the cake of a good marriage, not a good wedding cake. That may be true too, but the cake of a good marriage, a marriage that's sweet, a marriage that tastes good, a marriage that is nourishing. There's a lot of ingredients that go into that. I recognize it. But one of the ones that's most undervalued and overlooked is the ingredient of simple kindness. It becomes so easy over the years to begin to take one another for granted and begin to use rough words, harsh terms, and not express and show the kind of tenderness and kindness that we so see so beautifully illustrated here between Ruth and Boaz. For the guys, for the men, think about Boaz and his kindness for her. He is a provider. He looks and sees that she has a need, and he works diligently to make sure that that's taken care of. He sees what she needs and he provides for that. And that is so much of what a husband is to do. He is to be someone who looks ahead, to sees what the needs of the family are and makes the efforts that are necessary in order to provide for his family and for his children. And this is kindness to make that kind of provision. He protects her. He recognizes the danger that she is exposed to in her situation, her vulnerable situation. and he protects her. He doesn't become the one that she needs protection from. God forbid that husbands should ever be the one that a wife needs to seek protection from. This is a horrible inversion of the way God designed marriage to be. So we protect and we provide and we speak kindly. Nowhere does Boaz speak rudely or harshly to her. And a woman's heart is tender, and the words that her husband speaks to her have such a powerful impact on her life. And we need to speak those words of kindness into her heart. Boaz recognizes that other relationships that she has are important, and he, rather than trying to pull her away and get between her and her mother-in-law, he recognizes that her commitment to her mother-in-law is a valuable thing, and he supports and encourages that. And he respects her character and virtue. I don't know what kind of appearance physically Ruth had, but the thing over and over again that Boaz recognizes is her character. He's researched, he's found out things about her, and he knows the kind of kindness and loyalty and devotion that she has shown. And he thinks about that and he says, that's a good woman. That's the kind of woman that I want to pursue. And there's no hint throughout that he has any contempt for her. Husbands ought to show respect for their wives' character and virtue. And then there's kindness in wives that is illustrated well by Ruth. She expresses gratitude to Boaz for his provision and protection. She acknowledges what he's done. And sometimes I understand wives, particularly if you're Janice married to me, it can be difficult to find something positive to point out. But the most important thing, one of the most important things that you can do is when he does do something right, express gratitude for that. The more, if you notice as you read the story, that she says to him about how grateful she is to him for what he's done, the harder he works to provide even more. And guys can be easily discouraged if they think that their efforts are going unnoticed or unappreciated, but a husband who believes that what he's doing is making a difference for his wife and that she appreciates that and she verbalizes that to him will inspire him to try even harder to do more. And so it's a kind thing for a wife to express gratitude to her husband. She's also hardworking. She's not in the least bit lazy. And a wife that works hard to help with the family and to do her job in the family is one that will be a blessing and a kindness to her husband. And she tells him, lastly, exactly what she needs from him. In chapter 3 and verse 9, she makes it very clear what it is that she needs from Boaz. Now, wives, this is very important. Men are notoriously poor communicators. So Janice has learned this with me. One of the things that she does, she's learned that even words are not enough. When she wants to communicate a concept to me, she needs to use hand signals. In addition to words, I need a box, because if I just hear box, I'm probably, there's no, but she has to, you know, this is what I need. She makes it very clear what it is that I need to do or what she needs from me. And wives can very easily assume, well, he ought to know. And sometimes women mistakenly think, well, if I have to tell him, then it's, you know, then I don't want it at all. Well, then you're probably not going to get it at all because, yeah, we've got a, you know, a thick skull. Make good for, you know, hard knocks, but not so much for getting the message in. So you've got to be explicit and clear. Ruth is very clear in communicating to Boaz what she needs from him. And Boaz responds well. And it's a kind thing when a woman communicates clearly so that her husband is not left trying to figure out what it is that she really wants. So out of the bleakness and the darkness of the days of Judges shines two wonderful examples of goodness and kindness. And a really interesting thing at the end of this story is that they get married and have a baby boy in Bethlehem. And his name is Obed. And centuries later, directly descended from Ruth and Boaz, are another kind and good young couple named Mary and Joseph. And though the circumstances of her conception are certainly different, God blesses them with a baby boy in Bethlehem. who becomes bread for the world in the house of bread where often there was before so little bread. The goodness and kindness of our God appeared, and we are all the beneficiaries of that. Let his goodness and kindness to us bear fruit in our lives as we are good and kind to one another. Thank you so much for your attention this morning.